Hello, and welcome to the National Library of Australia. I'm George Dunford, the Director of Digital Engagement. As we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land for which we meet, on which we meet. I thank their elders, past and present, for caring for this land that we are now privileged to call home. Today's talk is a digital culture talk that looks at news online and how we shift from page to pixel and how that's affected journalism and journalists. Today, you're more likely to get your news from BuzzFeed than The Australian. And that news, you won't be pointed to that news by a news agent, you'll probably get it through Facebook. Joining us to sort through the new news is Sophie Black, the former editor of Crikey, Australia's preeminent online news service. As well as serving as the director of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, Sophie has gone on to become the editor-in-chief at Private Media, which publishes Crikey, Women's Agenda, and the public sector journal The Mandarin. Also joining us all the way from Canberra is Paul Daly. Paul is a Walkley Award-winning journalist and novelist whose recent political novel featured the National Library's own Petherick Reading Room, which we always like to see. he writes about Indigenous affairs and national identity for The Guardian Online after a rich career in print media. And finally, joining us on the end, all the way from Sydney, is Tim Duggan, who is responsible for all of those irresistibly clickable images of cats and intriguing lists that distract you every day on Junkie. But Junkie's an interesting story because they had a unique take on the Sydney siege in December 2014 that I think Tim will talk some more about as we go to our conversation. It's one of several sites, including music sites, Mess and Noise, and Faster and Louder, that is created Tim has created at the Sound Alliance. Recently, the Sound Alliance has also launched a travel title called AWOL in partnership with Qantas, which Tim will tell us some more about. But first of all, I'd like to get each of our speakers to talk a little bit about where they see themselves in relation to online news. And we'll start with Sophie Black.
Thanks, George. Yes, as George mentioned, I am former editor of Crikey and now editor-in-chief at Private Media, which publishes Crikey and six other titles. The Mandarin is our latest title, based here in Canberra, and serves the audience of the public service and is everything to do with the public service. But we also have a couple of business publications, such as Smart Company and Startup Smart, and the other titles that you see up there. But in thinking about the sort of topic around this talk, I thought about the fact that I've recently been consumed with working on Crikey's 15th birthday campaign. Internet years work a little bit like dog years, so that means we're about 103 years old now. And so this is the first Crikey that you can see here. Pretty basic. Had some great stories, though, incidentally. So to mark the occasion, we've been constructing a bit of a timeline of the past, present and future of online media, starting with our birth year of 2000. And looking back at the innovations in online media over the last 15 years has been a really fascinating process. Does anyone remember Second Life? That was a thing. It's still around, but yeah. And the Facebook, so there's the sort of first iteration of the Facebook up there, now better known as Facebook. But, you know, looking back, this sort of forced us to think of a world without Wikipedia, without Twitter, without Google News, or Grumpy Cat, which is really quite unimaginable. All innovations that have landed in the last 15 years. But then we got to the hard bit, which is writing the next 15 years. And the truth is we have no idea, and neither does anybody else. The chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, recently said that 20 years down the track, when the Internet of Things becomes our reality, the internet will seemingly disappear. We'll be so absorbed in the digital connectivity of our lives that we'll no longer notice it at all. So media experts are warning brands at the moment to prepare for a post-screen world. And there are examples like venture capitalist Fred Wilson, who declared at the end of last year that social media is now dead, in case you didn't get the memo. So what does this unimaginable pace of change mean for the media, and how can we possibly keep up? The funny thing about Crikey is that we are pretty much the same as we were 15 years ago, only with many more readers across a few, several different platforms that didn't exist 15 years ago. But essentially, we're an email newsletter. Lucky for us, the email is undergoing something of a renaissance. Quartz's daily brief is the must-have inbox item at the moment, and so too the podcast is having its time in the sun again. NPR's Serial over in the US was the most talked-about form of storytelling of the summer. So what's happening here? There's a trend emerging in the types of stories we want to consume and how we want to consume them. A recent story published on the storytelling platform Medium by Rex Sorgatz called Surfing, Drowning, Diving pointed out that media innovations in recent years have shifted away from an obsession with capturing everything to a fascination with exploring something. To quote, we are now in the era of the deep dive. Think piece, long form, recap, and binge watch. Think New York Times' amazing Snowfall and all the iterations that have come after that, Vox's explainers, Twitter's lists, and Vice's video. Working along these deeper forms of journalism are the faster, meaner sugar hits like the listicle, the live blog, and the terrible, but let's face it, horribly addictive Daily Mail sidebar of shame. So what unites the successful media outlets? They experiment. They create a space where people want to come back. They talk to and use their audience. They risk failure, and if they do fail, they talk about it. Their most valuable commodities are trust, transparency, connection with their audience, and community. Community is a particularly important aspect of the way that online media has developed, how you cultivate it, grow it, talk to it, and serve it. At Private Media, we serve a number of niche audiences, and we're striving to turn them into communities. Crikey was very good at this from the start. The founder, Stephen Mayne, was particularly adept at using his audience. And he did the very unthinkable very early on and asked his readers, who he called the Crikey Army, to help fill in the gaps. He bypassed the hubris of the traditional mastheads of the day by admitting when he didn't know something and asking his audience to help. And they immediately felt part of the project. And that's an approach, that's an approach we see mirrored across outlets today. It turns out there's a deeply social aspect to online news that has evolved in all sorts of unforeseen ways. It started with the journalist as salesperson. All good online reporters know that their story doesn't live and die in a day. They hit publish, then go about distributing their own yarn on social media. They promote it, and the really good ones talk back to their readers. The interaction with the audience is immediate, and it is certainly not finite. But we're also seeing a small section of audience who are hungry for even more, for the real-world meetup, for a community that extends beyond the comments section and into a space to meet and exchange ideas in the horror of horrors, flesh. The Serial podcast that took iTunes by storm over the summer is a good example of a seemingly solitary exercise that became a deeply social activity, a little like binge-watching your latest favourite TV series. The act of listening to a podcast itself is solitary, but then people absolutely had to write about it, talk about it, pay homage to it, and then bag it out. But this also mutated into something very strange and very lovely in the form of listening parties. For the Serial finale, I, along with hundreds of well-meaning nerds around the world, sat in on a listening party. This involved joining about 60 people in a cafe early before work to sit around, drink coffee, and listen intently for an hour in absolute silence. We ate cereal, get it, drank coffee, and had a wonderful time not talking to each other. We were essentially gathering around the wireless, and we loved it. So we may all be glued to our screen these days, but there is still a deeply social aspect to ourselves that means we want to share and tell and commune over stories. That means media companies need to be more than mastheads now. And in a new media world populated by countless news aggregators, you have to work harder to convince people to come back. And the value placed on belonging, membership, subscribing, being part of something, is morphing into media companies creating stories, events and products of their own. Witness The Guardian UK opening a complex the size of an aircraft hangar in the UK to host events. Looks a little bit like Second Life. We are offering similar services at private media, albeit more likely in a broom cupboard, with breakfasts, awards, monthly meetups and education offerings across all our mastheads. So in short, the way we tell stories, consume stories, tell stories and sell stories has changed fundamentally. Please somebody tell George Brandis. But the way we dig for stories remains fundamentally the same. Good stories take time and patience, all of which equals money. The reality, of course, of that can be out of whack with the reality of journalism in the digital age. Media companies and journalists have to work harder, smarter, and faster for less money, and these days with even more risk attached. As the government's data retention bills are set to be considered in the Senate today and late into the night, it's worth remembering that our journalists and their sources are threatened like never before. The contradiction of the great potential that the internet offers us to reinvent the way we tell and find stories is that it also offers up a myriad of ways for journalists and media outlets to be tracked and potentially silenced. We live in an era in which governments, both here and abroad, rhetoric around free speech is dangerously out of step with their aggressive surveillance agenda. Journalists in the digital age already had a hard slog ahead of them. It just got harder. Anyone who values a free and independent media, and by extension internet, must ensure that they educate themselves about the risks, not just to the media, but to themselves as citizens. And if nothing else, take inspiration from one of the great innovations of the last 15 years, the iconic Grumpy Cat. And angrily, or is that grumpily, demand accountability and scrutiny around this legislation. Thank you.
Hi, thanks very much for having me here today. On this topic, I thought perhaps the best way for me to deal with it was to, tell you something of my own story and my own journey through through the changes in print media where I've worked over the past 20, 25 years. So I'll start on the very first day of my journalism cadetship on a Fairfax regional newspaper. That was in 1987. I was shown my desk in a big dark office that was piled almost to the roof with old copies of newspapers and boxes containing sheaths of brittle yellow copy paper. If you can imagine, the place was lit by green desk lamps. There was no overhead lights and it was filled with smoke. Most journalists in those days smoked at their desks kind of permanently then. There were two seats facing each other at my desk and two telephones. I was obviously going to have to share the desk with another journalist who I hadn't yet met, but I saw a problem. There was just one typewriter there. The group editor had come from the head office at Footscray to Melton, where I was working, to welcome me on day one. And I said to him, "Well, there's only one typewriter on the desk." And he said, "That's because only one of you will need it at any one time. The other one will be out on the street getting stories or working the phone." Today, as the resources for all newspapers, and not least regionals, are being cut beyond the bone, it's hard to believe what I'm going to tell you about that newspaper, but there were four full-time journalists on this newspaper and a full-time editor as well. There was also a full-time photographer. There were six or seven titles in the group, served by four or five different newsrooms across the western suburbs. Bear in mind, I'm talking about suburban newspapers here. The papers often had 80 or 90 pages, about 50% of which was editorial. Each edition carried hundreds of display ads and thousands of classifieds. Today, most of those titles have folded. Those that haven't would be a fifth of the size, probably, and perhaps employ one journalist who does everything, including writing, subbing, and taking photographs. So the newspaper I work for, the Melton Mail Express, was written in the outer west of Melbourne, but it was produced and printed in Dandenong, perhaps 80 kilometres away in Melbourne's outer east. So in Melton, we gathered the news and typed it onto the little squares of copy paper and gave it to the editor, who would either cover it in pencil markings or reject it. But it rarely kind of went through unamended. And these little paperclip piles of copy paper were then put into a satchel, and George, who was a full-time courier, not this George, a different George, who visited the newsrooms, I think it was three times a day, drove them out to Dandenong, where they were sub-edited on the desk of five or six full-time subs and then placed on the page by the compositors, printed and then distributed by truck. All of this sounds kind of Dickensian now, and I'm not actually going to take you through every step on the road to convergence that brings us where we are today, except to say that about that time, two big things happened in my little workplace. The first is that the newspaper introduced very basic computer technology whereby we could type our stories on a rudimentary word processor and transmit them via a very slow but faster than courier dial-up modem. The second was that a fax machine was introduced into the office. George, the courier, was made redundant, and he was the first of thousands of casualties of technological advancement that I would see in print media while I worked in it full-time over the next 21 years. I walked away from full-time print journalism 21 years later when I was myself made redundant for the second time in my career. I was working as the National Affairs Editor of the culturally totemic Bulletin magazine, which had, despite its illustrious literary history, become a dinosaur of the journalism business. In its final decades, the magazine had dramatically dropped circulation to a point where it was selling less than 50,000 copies a week, despite having some excellent journalists who were writing high-quality, polished, well-researched and mostly long-form pieces. Quite simply, this good journalism cost an awful lot of money to make, and the magazine, in its current form, could no longer pay for it. For me and the tenured mid-career journalists around me, there had never been any question. Advertising would always pay our wages and underwrite the costs of the expensive journalism that we produced. But advertisers didn't need to pay to put their ads in these print products anymore, and even the exorbitant cover prices of the magazines and papers couldn't go anywhere near to covering the costs. The signs were everywhere, of course, and had been for years, but there was too much complacency amongst the traditional publishers. James Packer wanted to invest in casinos, not old media, but it wasn't all his fault. Those who managed the Bulletin also killed it. Like the people that ran and continue to run Fairfax and News Limited, for too long they failed to acknowledge, let alone take advantage of the opportunities presented by the advent of the World Wide Web. And when they refused to seriously compete with the young digital players on the field, they failed themselves. They failed to commit properly early enough to online news products that carried their brand. These products were treated as separate, poor-relation businesses when they were eventually established. They were understaffed compared to the legacy print platforms with junior personnel. I recall working for The Age in the Canberra Bureau in 2000. I was a political correspondent there. And we had just received another technological update, a new computer terminal each, complete with email and web access. Crikey had not long been established. We were all reading it, and we were all arguing about its long-term viability and whether it was merely a frivolous gimmick or at the vanguard of the future. I thought the latter at the time, and something else gave me a glimpse of the future too. Along the corridor, a very accomplished journalist, Tom Burton, an old friend, had recently been exiled from the Australian Financial Review. He's now the editor-in-chief of private media's The Mandarin. Anyway, he was stuck in a small office away from the rest of Fairfax, and he was the entire groups, that is, three or four newspapers, he was their political online guy. So the newspapers weren't taking it seriously, but Tom certainly was. He broke stories on the web every single day, stories that were conveniently ignored by the legacy print products, for the most part, or appropriated and claimed. At that time, it was absolutely apparent to me that all print journalists would be working this way before too long. Still, it would be another five, six, 7 years before the old print players decided that they'd have to adopt an online-first strategy. And even then, they were still half-hearted about it. They were just so sentimentally wedded to the old products. So they adopted clunky, siloed business models, and they still paid too little detail to layout, quality and user friendliness. They're a long way behind so many good, innovative, quality outfits that were producing online-only products in Australia and overseas, outfits that were staffed with young, fast, equally clever and ambitious journalists, many of whom had never worked in old media. This was the only journalism they had known, and many of them were very, very good at it, and are. Some older journalists criticise the approach and methods of their younger counterparts. They say they're fast and loose, that they value speed ahead of accuracy, and are obsessed with social media reach, especially through Twitter, at the expense of depth and polish. Well, there's always been fast and loose, fly-by-the-seat-of-the-pants journalists, those who'd compromise truth and accuracy for an easy byline. The web's accommodation of immediate filing and posting of stories and Twitter's capacity to spread the word has perhaps made it easier for the fast and loose. But social media is an incredibly harsh critic too, and it magnifies mistakes, sloppy practice and undeclared partisanship. There's a tight compact with the reader these days. As soon as you file a story and have it posted online, it is no longer yours. It is there for others, including the subjects or other experts, to immediately evaluate and criticise. It takes a while to get used to this, but I would argue that journalists ignore this conversation at their peril. I won't go on at length about how the web has enhanced journalistic capacity. Research tasks that could once take weeks, for example, can be accomplished in minutes. And the simple act of filing stories from, for example, war zones or other remote places is made simple by the smartphone and web access, which can usually be found. I think the current crop of younger journalists work much harder under far greater pressure than many of their predecessors. They have to think faster, make quicker judgments, write and deliver in a fraction of time that their predecessors had. That said, old media companies who are determined to cling to print are cutting too deeply and have dangerously compromised the quality of their legacy products. Web-only news deliverers, meanwhile, have begun life doing far more with less while striving for the quality that can win market share, although there is, in my view, an overemphasis on comment rather than news. Field opinion, as my friend Catherine Murphy calls it. It's cheaper and easier to produce than news or polished long-form research-heavy writing. So what about the remaining old dogs of the print world? How have they coped? Many have left, content that they've seen the best days. Others in midlife and mid-career have stayed and adapted. Many have done so wonderfully and have embraced the digital-first or digital-only model with all of the creative opportunity that it presents. I opted for a writing life outside full-time journalism after the Bulletin closed. I did this mainly because there were other things I wanted to dedicate my life to writing, both fiction and non-fiction, long form and short form. That said, I retain a commitment to journalism too, dedicating maybe a third or half of my writing time to mostly long form articles about Indigenous culture and history and Australian national identity. I've found a niche at The Guardian which is committed to these issues I care pretty deeply about. I also write pro bono for another important Australian website called Honest History, which seeks to balance the Anzac-centric militarism that is imbuing our national narrative with other Australian achievements and moments of note from a rich 60,000-year continental history. I've also written pro bono for Wendy Harmer's The Hoopla, which was, I think, an excellent and well-conceived and well-edited site, whose closure, sadly, was announced yesterday, I think. Commercial reality got the better of The Hoopla, unfortunately. But I still like to get my print fix, so several times a year I write long, sometimes very long, pieces for literary journals such as Meange, and those pieces also eventually gain an online life to complement the print version. So I note with interest David Walsh's investment in the Fantastic Island magazine, and not least his decision to make the article stories and prose available only in the print product, which is kind of swimming upstream in terms of what the rest of the market is doing, I think. I do wonder how this is going to work. The answer is I really don't know, but I'll leave it to those on the commercial side of these ventures to ponder that publicly. Meanwhile, of course, after the initial feeling of illness I always experience when one of my new books comes in the mail, I still love the feel of holding, my work in printed form like a book. I think books will still be around for the duration of my writing life, which is hopefully a long one. But I suspect that all but the most unique, high-quality, small-circulation, niche print journalism products will not be. Once, not too many years ago, I don't think I would ever have conceived of writing narrative or literary non-fiction or fiction for online only. I've always wanted to hold a printed version of the works of which I'm proudest. But a few months ago, there was a breakthrough for me. An online publisher asked me to write a piece of short fiction for their product, and I thought hard about it and wondered whether I could actually stand the idea of it not appearing in print. But I did it, and to my surprise, when it kind of lobbed on my iPad, I was very, very pleasantly surprised. I could cope with it. So maybe that is actually a sign of things to come for the future for me. I couldn't touch it on the page, but you know, I'm not too sure that in the end I'll ultimately care that much. But thanks for listening anyway. It's great to be here.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Tim Duggan, and I am the content director and one of the owners of a company called Sound Alliance. So we are one of the new media. We're in fact an old new media company, because we started about 2 weeks before Crikey did, so it must have been a very fertile time. Yeah. There was a DJ, there was his girlfriend, and there was a backpacker. And they started a website called In The Mix, which at the time was about electronic dance music. And over the ensuing 15 years, Sound Alliance has grown to become one of Australia's leading independent new media publishers. If these titles aren't familiar to people in this room, then ask any 18 to 35-year-old. It could be a friend, a family member, a son, because that's who we publish for. We publish for Australia's youth, 18 to 35-year-olds. And the top six are websites that we own and operate, and the bottom three are ones that we publish, that we represent in Australia. So In The Mix is an electronic music website, so it covers all dance music and festivals and parties. Faster Louder is a live music website, so it covers everything that In The Mix doesn't, the other side of music. Mess & Noise is an Australian independent publication, which covers independent Australian music. Same as National Gay and Lesbian website. But the two most interesting ones are our two newest babies on the right-hand side, Junkie and AWOL. Junkie launched in March 2013, and it has grown in the 2 years to be our biggest site by far. Junkie has about 1.4 million Australians coming to it each month, and in total and across our network, there's about 2.5 million people each month, most of them 18 to 35-year-olds. We're based in Sydney. We've got an office in Melbourne. We've got about 30 staff, of which about 20 of those fall into the editorial and marketing side. But there's a lot of bang for buck amongst these publications. Each of these sites has about 2 editors on there, in total we produce about 1,500 pieces of content a month. AWOL is the one that I think we're going to touch on a little bit later with George. AWOL was a really interesting model for us, so it is a travel title. It's all about inspiring young people to travel the world, but it's in partnership with Qantas. So we went to Qantas, and they own this title, and we run it for them for the next at least 5 years. I'll talk about that model a little bit later, but as a publisher, we've been around for 15 years, and if you think about the move from newspapers to online, like that has been obviously a massive shift, and we've heard a little bit about that. But the shift that's happened in the past couple of years has been even greater than that. And for us, that shift was mobile. So our audience, 18 to 35-year-olds, is what we call, they're the future consumers of tomorrow. So these are the people who are going to be reading The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. Some of them might be reading it currently, but they're certainly going to be the primary audience in about 10, 20 years. And when the mobile phone, iPhone in particular, was launched, we saw a little bit of our traffic started coming through the mobile. And then over the past 5 years, it has increased exponentially to the point now that for our audience, for 18 to 35-year-olds, about 60% of them read our sites through the mobile. And that has massive ramifications for us. So not only, if you think newspapers are struggling figuring out how to monetize and, you know, work in a world where they've got to make money off a desktop advertising, to then try and make money off a mobile phone where the yield, you know, the page, the screen's a lot smaller, the yield is a lot smaller. So that's the biggest shift that's happening at the moment. And we saw this coming And the way that we dealt with it was we commissioned a lot of research. So our aim is we try and get inside the minds of our audience. So we want to be the experts on 18 to 35-year-olds. And I'll share with you just like three or four of the research insights that we did in 2013, because this led us to launch Junkie, which has been phenomenally successful since then. Any of these words mean anything to anyone? FOMO and FONC. So these are the two biggest fears that we found were driving young people's behaviour. So FOMO is kind of well known. FOMO means the fear of missing out. So that means that, you know, I have to go out on a Saturday night because I can't miss that party, or I need to go overseas because I can't miss going to Europe. But FONC was a new fear that we saw was driving a lot of things. And there's a reason, there's a relevancy to this, to the media thing. So FONC is the fear of not knowing. And we found that the fear of not knowing was becoming quite massive, and it was driving a lot of behaviour. So in particular, it was driving having to check your Facebook feed as soon as you woke up in the morning, just in case you missed something happened overnight, having to check it before you go to bed. This almost like this need to know what was going on in the world. And that, in the essence, was what led us to launch Junkie. So Junkie takes what's happening in the world and it turns it into, you know, youth speak, I suppose. It makes it funny, it makes it interesting, it makes it digestible for young people. So it alleviates their funk. It stops them not knowing. And it has been quite surprising, because when we originally launched Junkie, we launched it as pop culture. So it was film and it was TV. It was kind of like, you know, light, fluffy topics. And then we started doing some politics stuff. And up until that point, everyone told us that young people were apathetic about politics, that, you know, like, they didn't kind of care. And what we found was, in fact, they did care, but it had to be packaged in a way that was interesting to them. So that was funny. It was listicles, which we can go into a little bit later. It was had an opinion. And Junkie has 2.5 full-time staff members on it, and therefore we don't have the resources to do what The Guardian does. So what we do is we add commentary to things. So we will, instead of breaking the news, we'll see news that breaks, and then we'll put an opinion behind that. The other thing, I think I've got three research slides here, so I won't bore you too much with research, but this was fascinating, because Facebook, the dominance of Facebook as a platform for our audience, 18 to 35-year-old, is just phenomenal. So in the past, people would search out news. They would go and they would pick up the paper and they would even log into theage.com.au and see what's happening. And now, people are sitting back and expecting the news to come to them. And the primary way of our audience of 18 to 35-year-olds reaching this is through the Facebook feed. So in 2013, we asked them if they get more of the news from social media than they do from newspapers or TV. It was 53%. 2014, it was 65%. And in 2015, we're about to release these results in a couple of weeks' time. It's up to 76% of young people just get more of their news from social media. So there is both a challenge and an opportunity. And for us as a publisher, it's an amazing opportunity, because our aim is all about how do we get our content and our news into that Facebook feed. I could keep talking for ages, but I think I might stop and we might have some panel stuff here. I just want to finish off on one interesting quote here. A slide that I went through just before that was that Junkie won the title of the Media Brand of the Year last year, in our very first year, in which we beat out The Guardian, we beat out Mamma Mia, we beat out Spotify, we beat out Pedestrian, which is very exciting for us. But the way that we try and think about how we monetize our audience is we think of this principle here, which is stop interrupting what people are interested in and actually be what people are interested in. So the way that we make our money is we work with brands to create content for them that our audience is actually going to care about. So it's called native advertising, and it's taken off over the past couple of years. And it now accounts for us for about 40% of our revenues, up from 20% last year, up from 0% the year before. So without native advertising, we probably wouldn't be sitting here, because the way of monetizing content on a mobile is decreasing. But thanks to native advertising, thanks to actually writing content for brands that your audience is going to care about, we've been able to find a way that has been able to help us thrive over the past couple of years. I might finish up there. Thank you.
We might have a few questions between ourselves, and then we might throw two questions from the audience. So we'll just start with a little chat amongst ourselves here. Can you hear me on my microphone?
No.
No? Okay. Could we just maybe check that? Sorry, just one moment while we sort out technical difficulty.
We
We can yell.
There you go. Perfect. Oh, that's better? Okay, great. So we were talking about money, and it's interesting talking about the Hoopla, which has been around for 4 years. One of the things that they were really committed to was making sure they paid their writers. And in their farewell letter, that was one of the things they lamented as well, that they were unable to continue to pay their writers. I think Crikey's a nice point to start on here because they have upwards of 17,000 subscribers to the newsletter, but I think you've got quite a diverse way of trying to get income with Crikey and with other titles within private media.
Yeah, we have pretty much 7 different little business models at private media. They're all trying slightly different things. We're really hedging our bets. But Crikey is fascinating because it turns out that we hit on a very successful, Stephen Mayne hit on a very successful business model very early on, and I don't know if we could replicate that today. But he managed to convince people back in 2000 to pay $30 for a subscription, and that was a pretty novel approach to suggest that there was value in an email, because it did come back to that, even that tactile thing of I need to hold this thing in my hands and what do you mean it's not available, you know, in print, and to the point where some subscribers continued to print out all 30-something pages of the email to read it on the train. This is before mobiles, before smartphones. So we just built on that. We built on the premise that our value was worth our content was worth paying for. And we have to remain committed to that. So that means we have to continue to produce stories and journalism that is of value. And so that means paying our writers properly and constantly coming up with surprising and engaging ways of covering the news as well. But we also, we're trying for the best of both worlds. So we have the subscription model in which people pay a certain amount of money for a yearly subscription and they get the email in their inbox 5 days a week and access to the website. And we also have a website that has a paywall but also has an amount of free content. The Hoopla was interesting because they talked about the fact that they put up a hard paywall about 3 years in. And they concede that led to their demise. So the paywall is a really tricky one to get right because you absolutely have to keep ensuring that you're part of the conversation because of this, the way that mobile has changed everything and the fact that many people are sharing and obtaining their news on social media, you have to be part of that conversation. And putting a paywall over all of your content means you cease to exist to most people. So we have to make sure we navigate that balance. So that's the only publication in our stable with a paywall. Everyone else has different models, including Women's Agenda has huge events, and that is turning out to be the best revenue stream for that particular model. Smart Company has a lot of display advertising, but increasingly branded content and native advertising is coming into play because that is absolutely the way that the industry is heading. So we're dipping into all of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tim, you were talking about AWOL too, which is the travel title, and that's a 100% partnership with Qantas. In terms of, and there must be some challenges there editorially where Qantas might be informing your content more than you'd like. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so AWOL essentially is a giant native advertising play. It's probably one of the country's biggest native advertising players, where the audience doesn't necessarily, you know, everything's signposted, we're not trying to fool people, but what we're trying to do is just inspire people to get on a plane and go somewhere. And that could be go to Melbourne for a weekend, it could be go to Europe to visit art galleries, it could be go to Ibiza and go clubbing. And it's 5 months old. We have incremental traffic growth every month for 5 months. In fact, we're at our the KPI of where we plan to be by the second year. We are by the fifth month in terms of traffic, which is exciting for us. But it is it has to play within Qantas's rules. So it is a Qantas publication. It is a really interesting business model for us because it's the first time where we haven't owned and operated our own site, we've gone to someone else. And if you think about it, it's almost like custom publishing. So in the past, there was ACPs and there was Bowers and they did the Australian Way, you know, the magazine you get when you go on Qantas. And this is a new digital format of that for young people that's accessible all the time. So we're kind of using an old business model, which is custom publishing, but doing it for the digital era.
Mm. Do you think your readership's aware of that partnership, or do you think that...
They are, yeah. We've done some brand studies recently, and we asked people that came to AWOL what they thought of Qantas, and then we asked people that came to the rest of our network what they thought of Qantas. And the difference of people that came to AWOL and started seeing this content that is, you know, it's really good, fun, snackable, inspiring content, and people thought twice as well of Qantas after coming to AWOL than they did from on the other side. So not only are they aware it's Qantas, but that actually makes them think better about the brand.
Mm-hmm. Paul, perhaps as a journalist you could comment on that editorial advertising tension. I think Fairfax, for example, has a thing called the Media Charter, which says that when you're being editorial and when you're being advertising, you have to make quite a distinction. Mm. Have you found that a challenge in your developing career?
Look, it was an issue for every journalist at some point, I think... particularly if they worked at Fairfax in the years where suddenly a decision was made to actually stop accepting what were known as junkets from the travel industry. Now, the truth is that travel journalism, like motoring journalism, is well nigh impossible to afford unless there is some kind of arrangement with the people that are in the travel industry. But I never sort of had a problem with it personally, when I was, when I wrote a travel story once or twice for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and later for, I wrote a couple of pieces for Gourmet Traveller when I was freelancing, I didn't have a problem doing it so long as the fact that the travel was sponsored was clearly identified. And there were cases where, I bagged out things that were given to us gratis. So I think so long as the advertiser understands that that's a possibility too, then the compact is fine. The compact with the reader has got to be transparent about it.
That's an interesting point you made too about that compact with the reader and how readers are so much more aware of the publication. And I think, Tim, possibly what Junkie and other publications that are very active online do is look at their analytics a lot more. Do you skew your content towards analytics, and if something works well, are you going there again as a topic?
Yeah, so we consider all of our editors to be data experts in a way, and the majority of our editors are within the target market, so the majority 18 to 35, and they all have two screens. So one screen is what they're writing, and the other screen is real-time analytics for what's happening on their site at any given time. So they can see who's on there, what are they reading, how long they're spending on site, and that completely changes everything, because you no longer I think from the print days where you would publish something and you might get a feedback, you might get a letter to the editor a couple of days later, and that was your feedback. This is within 5 seconds of something going live, you can tell if the audience wants that or not.
Yeah, I'd just say as a writer, this whole analytics thing is absolutely terrifying, because you hear back from editors precisely how many words your piece was, how long it should take someone to read through it, and how far they did actually read through it. So it creates challenges for writers too, to create different points of entry into stories and for layout as well. You've got to find ways to entice people to keep reading.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about listicles, which is a portmanteau of a list and an article brought together, for those of you who may not know. And that's a lot of Junkies' love, isn't it? And they do very well. The opposite of that, I suppose, is the longer form article that people are chasing as well. How do you balance those things, I think both Sophie and Tim, in terms of giving people what they want, the short snacks and the more substantial meals?
Yeah, the way I like to view of it is that our audience is just like any of us here, which is sometimes you want a three-course meal and other times you want to eat McDonald's. Sometimes you want a listicle, which is a short, sharp way of explaining piece of information that you might want to view as you're on a bus going to university and you've got, you've got a minute. And then other times you want long form. So long form is like a long, in-depth piece of content. And I'll give you like a great example on Junkie. So Junkie's whole thing is it's all about the things, from the things that matter to the things that don't. So one of the things that we put up a story on Scott Ludlam, who at the time was a pretty unknown West Australian senator, and he gave a speech to the West Australian Parliament, to the West Australian Senate, about, it was an anti-Tony Abbott speech. It was empty. It was kind of like his statement piece. We saw this on Junkie, and it was kind of one of these like small pieces. We put it up, and within 2 days, it had 1 million views on Junkie. And we're like, okay, this is quite interesting. That was kind of like a short, sharp, it took the writer, 10 minutes to kind of pump that story out. And what we then thought was like, okay, let's now go the other end and let's do a long form. So we sent a journalist over to Perth to be embedded with him for a week in the lead up to the election that he ended up winning. And we published this kind of 10,000 piece long form that was like words and pictures, and ended up getting the journalist nominated for a Young Walkley Award. And that's the perfect example of kind of like the short, sharp pieces is a really interesting way of telling that story, all the way through to long form, which was another interesting way of telling it. It all depends on what the topic is.
Mm-hmm. And they can be just as valuable. A really good listicle is an art form. Mm. And, I've seen listicles on Junkie about and on BuzzFeed about feminism, which I have found incredibly enlightening and can be really funny and witty and sharp and cut right to the heart of the thing. That's a good listicle. They're not all like that. And readers are learning to appreciate that there are different ways of telling the same story and just as valuable ways.
And the editors as well. Like there's such a wide gamut now. So when we get a story, we can sit there and go, do we want to tell this in GIFs? Do we want to tell it in getting a cartoonist to create illustrations? Do we want to write a long form? Do we want to run a list? Do we want to put YouTube clicks in there? Do we want to put SoundCloud embeds? Like there's literally kind of 20 or 30 different ways of telling the same story, and that I think is quite liberating for an editor because they can find the best way of telling it.
And that it's just another example of that. Embracing that ethos of experimenting and seeing what works, and we're all learning as we go along with this medium because it's so relatively new.
Or conduct an interview in emoticons.
Totally.
Smiley face.
Yeah, BuzzFeed did that. They did an interview with Julie Bishop just in emoticons. I think that was amazing. There's not a day goes past where our editorial team don't email around an innovative way of someone doing something interesting. Video is the new kind of holy grail of content because the audience, video on mobile in particular, is something that's really going through the roof at the moment. So telling a story through video, that opens up another 100 different possibilities.
I think what Sophie was saying earlier too about the podcast is true as well. I think the podcast is a absolutely fantastic medium because so much of social media is kind of busy and you're kind of constantly with other people, it feels like that. The podcast, you're alone with the subject and the voice, and I think it's kind of plays into perhaps the solitude that some of us are seeking in this kind of crazy, frenetic social media overload world, Yeah.
And possibly the longer read, too, is something like that, where people do want to take something away and read
sure.
it. I think in Crikey, for example, you often do an e-book of Guy Rundle's work, a collection of his columns and things like that. How does that sort of progression work for Crikey, having a short column and then compiling them again? Do people come back and experience it again?
Absolutely. We've learnt as we go that there are different types of content that people want to experience across different times of the day, really. So a lot of that habit is formed from the way the technology has morphed into smartphones, and so you're on the train, you're commuting to work, so you might want a quick kind of email recap of what's happened in the last 24 hours. You check your social media. You get into work, you're stuck to your desktop, so you might look at some homepages then. When you get home, you might get the iPad out and you want to have a decent read or you're in bed. And so we've come to sort of co-opt our that same material in different ways for those different needs. And you're seeing the ABC do that now. Radio National, repurposing their content, their radio content into beautiful visual publications that can be consumed on the iPad.
Yeah.
So it's essentially the same content, but it's a different way of enjoying it and consuming it.
Yep. I think White Paper is the...
White Paper, that's the name.
Yeah. I do want to get time for some questions from the audience, but I'd perhaps like to ask each of you before we wrap up, what does a journalist look like today? I think we've had a few mentions here of them being able to not just write but to amplify. You've got people who are, you know, data analysts as much as being writers. I wonder if each of you could give us a quick portrait of what you think a journalist today has to be and perhaps where they're going to.
Sure, I'll start. So some of our the journalists on Junkie are so curious about the world, obviously, but then curious about how to tell that story. And they use so many different ways of telling it. Anytime we put up a job ad for a job ad on Junkie or at any of our sites, we get hundreds and hundreds of people applying. And there's this real, I think within the youth space, certainly kind of with journalists that have kind of just come out of university, there is this real need to kind of want to tell their story and want to kind of shake the system. And I think that probably hasn't changed in 30 or 40 years. The same people, it's just a different medium.
The first thing I'd say is that I think the days of, you know, tenured, secure, really well-paid employment are pretty much over for journalists. So young journalists these days need to realise that, you know, it's got to be passion rather than job security that's going to drive them. And that's unfortunate in some senses. But I think the young journalist today looks very different to the young journalist of 25 years ago. They've got to be technically multi-skilled for a start. You know, they can't be too precious to take photographs, to do everything online, to do voice, to do video. They need to do social media, and they need to engage with, electronic media too, traditional electronic media. So I think the lot of the young journalist is much harder. But as I said, I don't see that overall standards have slipped dramatically. I think there's still a whole lot of good journalism being done, and you know, I'm quite hopeful as the convergence kind of works through the system that the future's okay.
I agree. So I think a good journalist has the same qualities a good journalist has always had. They're curious about the world, and they have a commitment to accuracy, and they think deeply about issues, and they come up with fresh angles on stories and new ways of covering those stories. So, you know, as Tim and Paul have said, that means you have to be able to tell the story on several different platforms all at the same time, in several different mediums. But I think that the important thing is that these journalists still have a good grounding in what makes a good investigative journalist. So how to initially dig those stories out, tease those stories out. It's just that they have to do it a lot faster. So transparency is a very, very important thing for an online journo. If you get it wrong, you own up to it. If something's breaking, you denote the fact that it's breaking and that there are different ways of continuing to cover the story while the information breaks. So it is a lot harder and a lot faster, but it is very exciting too. It's a really exciting time to be a journalist.
A great note to throw to audience questions on. Just before we kick off audience questions, we're really quite traditional about questions. They're generally things that have one sentence and a question mark on the end, not a statement, not a blog post. So if you've got one of those questions, if you could put up your hand now, we've got some roving microphones who will find you. Perhaps just up the back there.
Hello, I was curious to know about the unique take on the Lind Cafe siege.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah, cool. So the day that happened, we've always said that our sites should add to the conversation, not just add to the noise. And that day, there was so much noise in the media. So there was your Ray Hadleys on radio, there was Mamma Mia down there doing 7 posts an hour. Just everyone was adding to the noise. And what we normally publish, as I said, 1,500 pieces a month, so I can't figure out what that is a day. But a lot of pieces, a number of pieces a day. And what we said was stop. So we stopped across all seven of our titles. We didn't publish one thing. And Junkie put up one story that was, can everyone just be quiet and stop? And because everyone, you know, on social media, there was tweeting, people like, there's bombs here and there's that. And it was this mass hysteria. And we did the exact opposite. And not for any kind of greater reason, rather that we just didn't want to add to the noise. And the ironic thing was that was one of our busiest days ever of traffic, because that Junkie story got shared 500,000 times. But that was not the point. The point was to stop so that well-resourced, proper news organisations like The Guardian, BuzzFeed, who actually did an amazing job down there, the Sydney Morning Herald, they could do their job and everyone could just stop and listen, because it was too important for us to just use it as a way of getting cheap clicks.
Great. The gentleman just there, perhaps?
I think I heard the other day that The Guardian had lost 10 million since it started in Australia. Is there a danger it will go the same way as The Bulletin?
Will The Guardian go the same way as The Bulletin? Look, I'm the wrong person to ask. I write for them, but I don't. I don't have any great insight into their Australian business model. They pay me to write for them, and I do that. So
I'll give you a clue, though. So The Guardian's office is around the corner from ours, and we do a lot of stuff with them. And they have recently just moved offices because they're planning on being there for, don't quote me, but say, you know, 3 or 5 years. And after a year, they had more staff than they needed. So I think they're going ahead of their projections. They've got something like 70 or 80 staff now. I think The Guardian's arrival in Australia has been super exciting and great for the industry. And the reason why also is because they're building their business model from digital up. So as opposed to the print that's having to kind of cut down, they're building it from the bottom up, which I think is only going to be successful.
Yeah, I don't kind of mean to dead bat your question, but I just don't have any huge insight into what their, you know, medium-term financial plan is. But going into the office there, I don't get the sense that, you know, they're going any, you know, they're going to disappear quickly, or that they're going to go the way of The Bulletin, because they are, you know, web only in Australia and in the United States at the moment. And I think it's no secret that their medium term plan in the UK is web only too. Mm-hmm.
And The Guardian, I think, have a really unique business model in that they're funded by a trust. And when they came to Australia, they actually did that because they saw that a lot of their traffic to their UK site was coming from Australia. So they thought, we're going to follow those analytics, we're going to find that audience that's here. So a really good basis for their experiment. Any other questions?
Thank you. Yes, most of the speakers have mentioned paywalls, meaning subscribers have to pay for access to full content. So what about the people in the community who can't pay? And how do you imagine they access? And do you see a role for libraries in providing access to your content for those that cannot afford to subscribe?
Great question.
Our site is unusual, crikey, in that everything comes out from behind the paywall 2 weeks after it's been published. So we find that the people who do subscribe to Crikey subscribe to the idea of getting that information before anyone else, or that particular analysis. Share, you know, kind of having it as a part of their arsenal in terms of, you know, having interesting conversations around the dinner party table and that sort of thing. They also subscribe to be part of something, because they might be subscribing to the idea of independent journalism and they want to support that. But, you know, I recognise that Crikey serves a niche audience. It's not a general news site. And I think we've seen that the experiment around paywalls around general news sites has been much less successful.
I'm not sure anyone else has a paywall here.
No, we don't, and all of our content will always be free for anyone who wants to read it.
And the role of libraries, I noticed before you had Crikey Page One, that's something that, so we have a web archiving project here called Pandora, which has many, many old editions of culturally significant websites in Australia, including Crikey. What do you see as the role of libraries in preserving and offering access to your material?
Oh, I think it's imperative, and I think it's fantastic. I just noticed the other day I rejoined the ACT Library Service, and that card gives me access to so many, so many products, fantastic products from all over the world that I would have to otherwise pay for. And in terms of archiving, true to the NLA's mandate, I think it's absolutely wonderful that the NLA is archiving all these culturally significant websites, just as it has archived, every print publication ever produced in this country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that might qualify as sponsored content, though.
Libraries are a really interesting example of institutions that are taking on a new life with the advent of the digital age. And they kind of tap into a little bit about what I talked about around the social aspect of sharing and talking and communing over stories. I think libraries are taking a leading role in that space. It's really interesting to see.
We might have time for just one more question if anybody's been burning. Just one there in the middle. Sorry.
Well, I'll shout in.
So that's a great question about whether journalism in the future will be demand-driven. Perhaps you can each respond to that.
I think it's going to be a bit of both. I think, and currently through, through this interaction with readers via the web and social media, but also the comments at the bottom of stories. I mean, publishers love their writers to go below the line, they call it, and talk to readers who comment on stories. And I think publishers are constantly taking that feedback about what people want and certainly what they don't want. And so I think in future you will get, it'll be more demand-driven, yeah.
Yeah, to me it's almost a little bit of the art versus the science. And we come from it from a science point of view, which is the analytics, and then the other angle is coming straight from, a hunch, and this is what the art side. I was on a panel recently with Wendy Harmer about 6 months ago, and we were talking about Hoopla, and we had a very robust discussion, and the answer was that right there in the middle. So we use the science, we use the analytics, what that tells us, to make what we create better. And at the same time, you need to have that art there. You do need to have some of that hunch and some of that, I don't care what the numbers say, I'm going to go after a story. And it's figuring out the challenge between the two, which I think is where the tension is going to be.
There was a lot of talk about clickbait and the dangers of clickbait, five or more years ago, really, when we saw journalists live or die by their numbers, their story numbers, and there were a few notable cases of journalists getting sacked because they weren't getting enough hits. Websites like The Age, Fairfax's websites, when they were back in that era of being very, very different to the newspaper, they chased clicks, and it undermined the credibility of the masthead, and they're still struggling to get that back. So publications have since realised that it's a mix of both. There is a role for gut instinct, and there is still very much a need to retain your credibility and the trust with your readers. So you can't just go after easy clicks. And advertising, the trends in advertising are now reflecting that, because display advertising online doesn't necessarily work, and traffic in itself doesn't necessarily have an inherent value. It's also about how your audience engages with you and whether they come back and whether they trust you. So I feel good about the future of journalism, even though in the top five stories listed in Crikey for all time, there is still one headline that persists, and it's about 10 years old, but it has the word small breasts in it. Ooh. And so it continues to remain there. I think we've gone past clickbait at this point.
I'd just say one more thing too. I mean, the readers may not, all the time say to news organisations, hey, this is what we want you to do. But there are some fundamentals like investigative journalism and holding government to account, particularly, that, you know, you may not always get a lot of love for because it's assumed that you're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that the foundations of good journalism are always going to rest with that stuff, and you're going to keep getting it. Whether you say, hey, I want that or not.
Yeah. Well, that's a good note to end on, knowing that the foundations of journalism are still very strong with our panellists today. I'd just like to also let you know that, in terms of sponsored content, again, that you can catch up on this talk and other talks at nla.gov.au/events, and we'll have the audio of this talk up shortly this week. Finally, could you join me in thanking our speakers, Sophie Black, Paul Daly and Tim Duggan.